Welcome to Artist Statement. Today we'll be talking to a young contemporary artist, Asher Lifton.
When I was a freshman in high school, I took my first film class and wrote a terrible comedy about a secret book club. It was my first year at a new school, so my co-director sourced the cast, and lo and behold, Asher Lifton agreed to play one of the stars. I was introduced to him on set, and while his acting talent is limited, he is a gifted artist and a lovely person, as exhibited by his willingness to participate in an unknown freshman's amateur film project as a senior. In high school, he could most often be found in the studio after hours, chatting with the eccentric but beloved art teachers. Fast forward 4 years, and we ended up at the same university, where I was thrilled to find that he was doing much of the same. While Asher has recently been recognized by many heavy hitters in the art world, I'm proud to say that I've been a fan since I was 14.
Drawing inspiration from his studies in cognitive science and art, Asher's unique approach to painting considers how visual perception is distorted through technological filtering. He translates a combination of photographs, AI-generated images, and famous art historical motifs onto his canvas through a systemized pointillism process. Since finishing college, Asher's work has been recognized by established critiques and artists like Robert Storr and Matt Keegan. And recently, this last fall, Nino Meyer Gallery announced the representation of the young artist. For this episode, we highly recommend that you browse through our recent Instagram posts, which contain images of Asher's work as well as his inspiration. Our handle is artists.statement.
Due to scheduling conflicts, this episode was recorded in mine and Leonie's living room, so you guys can enjoy all the added ambiance of ambulance sirens throughout our chat. With or without sirens, Asher's warmth and thoughtfulness comes through. We hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we did. So one of the reasons Leonie and I kind of started this podcast is because we realized there are so many talented and creative people that exist here at Yale, but the nature of its structure doesn't always foster that creativity. And we know that you studied here and did a dual major in cognitive science and art. And we were kind of wondering in what ways did studying art in an academic setting benefit your development as an artist? And in what ways, if any, did it kind of detract from it?
So I actually wasn't planning to be an art major. And I wasn't planning to be an artist in a weird way, because I was just did not think of those things as kind of feasible life trajectories.
Yeah.
I just ended up taking art classes, and then those were, I mean, have always been the classes that I've felt engaged in, like, and actually wanted to work at, if that makes sense, where, like, other classes were definitely, like, more of a labored kind of having to push myself to get interested. The structure of the art major forces you to kind of just throw out everything you know in some ways and just start from the basics. And then you realize very quickly that even, like, for me, I came in being like, well, I'm an artist. I already know a lot about art. And I realized very quickly that there was, like, a whole nother way of approaching making a painting that I had no experience with. And that kind of just, like, fundamental conceptualizing and kind of wiping the slate clean, I found really useful.
Yeah.
But also there was the cogsci side. It was, like, just thinking about how people interact with, you know, with something in a generalizable way, such that it's not subjective. Like, it's not like, what do I think about, how am I looking at this book in a different way than you are, right? It's how are we looking at it in the same way? And I thought that was really interesting, because it has to do more fundamentally with how our visual structures and how meaning is created in a more common way, and because cogsci is all breaking that down, whereas, like, a lot of the time in art, it's about differentiating. And and so I thought that kind of reversal was interesting. And then, like, designing an experiment, you're trying to think of humans as soft machines, right? You're thinking of people in a way such that by getting enough people to do something, you have enough data that's like, okay, this is generally how people work. And so I was just, I think that the freshness I was feeling and the kind of excitement I was feeling was all coming from those types of conversations at the time.
Right. And speaking of kind of dialing in on your work, I want to really hear a little bit about the breakdown of your technical process and, you know, start with the kind of nascent stage. I think that there's this idea that when you're creating art, there's like this strike of inspiration and then a flurry of creation.
Yeah.
But I was talking to a friend of mine who's an artist here, and she was kind of walking me through her process, and I was kind of blown away by the extent of time spent on kind of researching, prepping, mulling over the way that she wanted to manifest her thoughts, like, physically in her art. And I was wondering, like, how do you go about, like, looking for something to capture and then deciding what form it'll take in terms of your art? And is that, like, an active process, or does it feel more passive and, like, when you're ready to kind of receive it, you do?
Yeah, I think that there's... I mean, and like one thing I think you're describing is like this, these kind of romantic ideas associated with being an artist and being a painter versus a more formalized, labor-forward, kind of dumbed-down version of being a painter. And I think that I believe in both of them in a way, and my work is very, I think... based in those two things being coexistent, and I think that like the greatest example maybe this was useful is like Richter's work. Gerhard Richter's work has always been really important to me for that reason, because you know, he's this very cynical German painter who was deeply influenced by a very personal connection to World War II and responding to, you know, the optimism of pop art in the U.S. and still kind of has this contradictory relationship to painting, where he's very attached to this, to the romantic transcendent feeling that can come from painting which can also be described as a belief in beauty and the experience and the value of an experience of beauty in art and the kind of mysticism around that, and also feeling like that's no longer possible. And he basically, and I mean, to oversimplify, he kind of used the photograph as a foil to encompass both, where the photograph becomes of something that can be pretty and beautiful and traditional and conventional, you know, flowers and mother and child and portraiture and, you know, very beautiful effects of light that are kind of convincing and produce visual pleasure. But, you know, the fact that it's a painting of a photograph, the photograph becomes kind of a barrier from actually kind of allowing you to get to that thing. And so it both acknowledges the fact that you kind of, like, experience this thing while kind of allowing you to also feel that inability to achieve it. That idea is something that, like, I connected with. And so my work is very process-based now. And I have a very, I would say, iterative way of working, partially that I took from that CogSci practice, where, you know, if I did CogSci for another 10 years, that kind of looks like an iterative thing where you may do one experiment, you take some results from that, try it again, and then you change it very slightly, you know, and that, you know, for so many years, you know, psychoanalysis and psychology and have kind of taken large swings at, you know, figuring out how the brain works and gotten nowhere. And so a lot of CogSci was kind of saying, all right, let's piece together all these things and do like lots of tiny steps and see where we can get. And so I kind of wanted to bring that approach into my painting. So rather than, you know, starting from scratch and every time or swinging for the bleachers, you just kind of are like, you know, just trying to get a little bit further each time. Or not even further, just try to, like, change something small and see how that changes the whole thing. And so for that kind of approach, having a system with distinguished parts that can be altered and manipulated was really useful. So initially, I got to the current structure I'm using by... In my thesis, I had kind of played with grayscale pixelated image paintings where a photograph was broken down to pixels. Each pixel was given a number that was corresponded to a shade of black or white or gray. And then I was able to just very easily kind of blow that up and produce a painting from that. And I was like, I like this system, but if I keep doing this, it's not actually that interesting in terms of like been done, like not visually that complex or exciting. But I was thinking about the human visual system in CogSci at the same time, and thinking about, you know, like neural networks were first kind of becoming a topic in cognitive science. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of building information through layers of transparency was really interesting to me. And I was thinking about Picabia's transparencies, which are paintings basically layering classical figures and scenes in like a very kind of simplified painting manner. But through their layering, they become abstract and kind of strange. And so I was like, all right, instead of doing pixels, I'll not use oil. I'll use like kind of acrylic inks, which are much more watery and transparent. Or at the time, were like the most transparent thing I could think of. And so I looked to like the logic of like a color printer, which uses you know cyan, magenta, yellow, black, and basically just took the logic of painting pixels and instead broke the image down into those four color layers and then painted those each one at a time so that the image results from the interactions between the transparent layers. And what was most exciting about that for me was the immediacy of like having an image and then moving from image to constructing a painting. And the creation of the painting is in discrete parts that you have to piece together in the act of looking. And so that was very exciting. And I think also exciting because I could feel that there was just a lot of space for that type of iterative manipulation. Mm-hmm. And from that, a lot of the imagery I use and things I play with are kind of taking our historically conventional tropes and narratives and ideas and then running through something that, you know, goes into digital space and comes from photographs I take and find and very kind of like contemporary references and textures more so. And then running them through the system.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear all this after I've seen all of your works solely through digital, my computer. I think Amali had shown me one of your works from last year from an exhibition where you were a contributing artist. And I had initially thought that it was a tapestry because of that visual distortion that you were playing with. And I then kind of like looked through your website and your Instagram and had found, kind of kept looking at all of these images and thought that they were really poor quality like photographs.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that like, oh, okay, this is really interesting. Like, I'm not really sure what's going on here. And got very engaged though with this like act of my eye being strained and zooming in and trying to figure out and decipher the things that were happening in these compositions. And it's really interesting to hear that you are actually playing with a really intricate and precise layering process to create these kind of blurry images. Especially because I think when I think about art a lot of the time, and I think about the reception of art, I think about the process of translation, and I think of what gets lost in between, you know, an artist trying to express an idea and a viewer experiencing that idea.
Yeah.
And so to hear this like visual translation is really interesting because I've never really thought about the ways in which my eye can maybe gain or lose, I guess, experience. And it really made me think about the way you use texture, because I think texture is a massive part of that. And I guess I wonder, like, why do you want that, like, textural element in your paintings? Like, what does that do for you as a creator as well, if it is so painstakingly, you know, meticulous? And
that the sense to the paintings themselves are totally flat. The inks are painted on with grids, so that so the whole painting surface is gridded, and it's not in like a pixel grid. It's more of like a linear grid in terms of just being lines rather than squares that are filled in, if that makes sense. But because there are grids that are interacting in these layers, that's like a very similar visual structure to like a knit blanket.
Yeah.
I like that reference because, like, the Jacquard loom was like the, you know, predecessor for the computer, and so there's this kind of like this connection between knitting and fabrics and the, like, you know, early on what led to the digital computer. And so I like that kind of coevolution exists. The fact that they're hand-painted is very important because there's like when you see them on the phone or a computer, the camera is piecing the image back together in some ways,
mm-hmm.
where like a lot of what I'm doing is breaking it apart,
mm.
and so you lose that sense of fragmentation in some ways. That feeling you were describing of being like, what's going on here? Is it a poor quality photo? Is somewhat resolved in person because you first have that experience when you see it like across the room, and then you walk up to it and it breaks apart and you just see little dots and lines. And then it essentially becomes an abstract painting in some ways. And at that level, then what you're getting is touch. It's like the most, you know, it's a brush making a mark on a canvas, which is just the kind of most fundamental building block of painting. And so in that, when I'm painting it, I'm thinking about how the touch, you know, is done for that painting, whether it's slower, faster, kind of more, you know, like staccato, things that like read on a network level, which is like if I thin the inks more, they'll run more, and so you'll get drips and kind of like a watery surface. If I kind of make them more concentrated, they're a little darker, heavier, grittier, and it affects the overall kind of sense of the painting. And so the system that's like creating the painting is both material and information based or digital,
mm-hmm.
and so you have those two things kind of in conflict and being worked out in that physical object, like in the experience of looking at it, which is, I think, for me, where the excitement from the paintings comes from,
mm.
is feeling like those things are pushing on each other and not really resolving.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, which was you were kind of talking about the artists that you've drawn inspiration from. You mentioned,
yeah.
Richter, which is really interesting to me, especially because I've spent a lot of time thinking about German art and
yeah.
spent a lot of time specifically thinking about German Expressionism. And when I looked at your painting, the Ziggy Stardust painting, I was thinking about Max Beckmann a lot,
yeah.
Because of the way that you really distort the body and because of the facial expressions, I think, as well. Also, just generally looking at the titles of your paintings, which refer back to so many different, like, traditional Western or European painting motifs, like The Bathers,
yeah.
or Vermeer titles, like Adriano with a Scarf. Like, I really love those callbacks, but I want to hear a little bit more about, you know, how you have tackled, you know, a really broad European painting history and
yeah.
what you've selected and why you've selected
yeah.
it and brought it into, you know, a contemporary space and
yeah.
adjusted it to also fit into, you know, I guess the system that you use.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm glad you picked that up. It's like very, it's something I'm like that I get endless excitement from playing with. So in my work, I think, like, for example, the Ziggy Stardust triptych, yeah, it has I like the Beckman reference. I hadn't thought of that. A lot of what I was looking at was like Rubens and thinking about his like meaty figures and the sense of movement in those paintings. And again, it's like I love those paintings. And I also am dealing with, like, you know, I can't, it would be really funny if I tried to, like, make a Rubens painting today. Like, it just would not be right. And so it's like, how do you resolve that, you know, that contradiction, right? And so I use, at the time I was doing this, I was using, like, a really early stable diffusion model, which is, you know, Dolly or all of the, or I'm trying to think, what are the big ones? The like an image generation technology, and what was exciting to me about it was that it was still pretty bad, and so I could kind of get it to spit out these like forms and figures that were really distorted and weird, but that really came from like a specific, had enough specificity to them that they weren't just broken, but that weren't quite right, and so they kind of balanced that tension that I was looking for between those two things. And so I used those to kind of collage and make compositions where I could kind of create the movement I wanted and create the framing I wanted using these pieces that were, that looked like they were pulled from this tradition. And so there was kind of an inherent conflict in that, where I'm also putting it obviously into like a very digital structure that flattens it out. So there's not no space, there's not really form. But you kind of get this sense that kind of courses through it. And the Ziggy Stardust title was actually because I would have kind of like, when I was putting in prompts to create images, and this one, like one of the fundamental ones was like devouring Ziggy Stardust. And I've like always loved David Bowie, but the reason why I did it was first, I guess, just playful. But then what happened was, Ziggy Stardust is not in those paintings, or it was not in the images that I was getting, but he would be like diffused throughout the image, so you just get like these reds and these blues that are kind of coming from that, and you get kind of figures with like red manes, and you just get it becomes like an undercurrent through it. And which I thought was exciting, because it's just a new way of arriving at an image and having something kind of become like a distant force on something.
Yeah. No, I remember, or I read an artist bio of yours that mentioned that one of your influences was Chuck Close,
yeah.
Who through his portraiture found out that he had prosopagnosia, which is more colloquially called face blindness, and it was a term I came across in my psychology course, where we talked a lot, actually more than I thought we would,
yeah,
about like our kind of ocular mechanisms and the way that we process faces and how it is different to the way that we process like objects, for example. And I was wondering, you were talking about how like scale might distort perception of like the viewer in terms of portraits, but I was wondering whether you noticed whether in the process of capturing faces, you noticed the way that you were processing them was any different.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Chuck Close is a reference for multiple reasons. Partially, the color system is the same, because
mm-hmm.
He was doing a lot of, like, you know, working from photographs, and how do you get from a photograph to a painting?
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of his, bread and butter. And I think what's interesting about the face processing side of things is
mm-hmm.
that you know the largest area in your brain of association is for faces. It's like the most important thing that we have to recognize, and so it's represented that way, you know, biologically. I think the fundamental idea is the same, right? Where for him, using faces was, you know, a way of A, selecting subject matter so that kind of question could be checked off the box, or box could be checked off. It's very useful to know what your subject matter is, because then the play becomes formal and becomes in the process of painting. And in this idea of translation, which was really, I think, what he was interested in, right, is how do you get from point A to point B? And that's where, like, the fun in the paintings comes from, not from, like, recognizing or looking at the face, which is obviously different than if you were looking at a painting of a royal family done in 1600, when the painting would be much more about the person and the associations and those types of things. So there is a decoupling that happens there that's interesting. The subjects, I mean, it becomes about the act of looking, right, rather than what you're looking at, which definitely is like a shared interest. I would say that's kind of our common ground. When I'm working with human subjects, it's similarly not as much, you know, I paint a lot of people that I'm close with, because in part because they're around me and I'm using photographs that I take, and so it's like a matter of, like, to say convenience makes it sound a little brutal, but it's what's around me gets painted in a way. Mm-hmm. On another level, though, when I paint family, when I paint my girlfriend, when I paint close friends, there's a set or places that I'm like very kind of intimately attached to, like my studio. That sense of alienness carries through, which is that putting them through this formal system that becomes very literal. There's like a literalness to the paintings that can feel dispassionate, which I like. You know, like to go back to Richter, where like his main gesture is erasure, and which is like a negative, you know, an act of negation rather than, you know, creation. So there is like a sense of dispassionate gesture that I value in the paintings, and I think so when I use subjects that I'm very close with, I can again increase that that gap between subject and painting to make it feel as strange as possible, because it again just exaggerates that kind of sense of conflict.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear. When I was talking to Cleo, who I'm sure you know, who also plays with like technical manipulation and image distortion, she used the word, or she was talking about technology in the way that like techne, the Greek etymology of the word, which has a very clear reference to like craft and skill and art, but also has a connection to the idea of deception, which is pulled from like the Homeric contexts of like Odysseus being this deceptive but skillful and artful character. And so I'm really interested in how do you think about technology when you are engaging with it? It sounds like there's tension sometimes in your paintings with technology.
Yeah, I mean, I think the dumbest way of putting it would be that when you use new technology, you can make something that feels new and feels fresh. Anytime someone does that, there's something interesting to it. And so, like, I don't seek it out because it's new and I'm like, I can use this, like, to make a painting. I try to kind of push myself to try to incorporate them, because they just kind of ends up falling into a box, and then I'm like, all right, well, down the line, I'm working on a painting and I need to resolve some problem that I can't figure out. I'm like, oh, maybe this thing that I thought about a while ago will come in. I think that technology, and so, I mean, when it, like, I talked about, you know, Western art and specifically European painting is really important to me. Because a lot of the questions I'm involved with, specifically, that ends up being a little bit more Northern European, which historically is a little more involved with technology, because technology generally co-evolves with, you know, seeing things, and because seeing for so long was about discovering how the world works, right? Like you look into like something is smaller and smaller and smaller. It was like lenses or, you know, in doctors' offices, like the equipment, you know, is evolving kind of co-tangentially with technology and painting. And, you know, all these things there's an idea of truth in technology kind of coexisting. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that we've kind of arrived at an area where, like, it's you, rather than looking at the world, you're looking at information, right? So it's non-physical and it's not really about seeing.
Mm.
And so in my paintings, like, an image is information. So if I like distort it or if I blur something, right? These are like acts that you can only do because an image is information represented on a grid. If you're like, if I'm looking at flowers and painting it, you know, from life, then I can't do anything to the entire, I can like stretch the canvas or something more or less and like maybe try to warp the image that way, but none of my gestures will affect the whole thing all at once, which you can only do if the thing you're doing is immaterial and represented as information. And so this kind of play between information and material and physical is one of the games kind of going on in the background of a lot of the paintings that I kind of like to think about and make things from. Like the swirl paintings, like the gesture becomes a manipulation of information digitally that then becomes the kind of like more physical, embodied painterly gesture on the canvas that when you're looking at it, you're kind of responding to. And that transformation is interesting to me.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of transmission. It seems like your perspective informs your technical process, and then your technical process kind of feeds back and informs your perspective. But that all happens kind of in the isolation of the creative process. What happens then when you have eyes on your work? Like, in what way does having viewership and commentary on your work change your perspective on or your relationship to your work?
You know, it's like I like the macho artist would say, like, I don't think about other people. that's really not true. I definitely do think about like how people are looking at the things that I'm making. It's kind of central to it, and it's like a lot of what I've been saying is like that the common ways that we approach something are what interests me, just as much as how your experience will differ from my experience in looking at it. And and again, for that reason, genre and convention again plays into that sense of like, okay, you're not walking in and being punched in the face by these paintings. They're kind of like, at first there was a sense of familiarity, and that kind of allows you to settle in, and then you can figure out what's going on. You know, that's that same thing that like you first see it and it looks like an image, and the image is, can be, you know, looks like something you've seen before, and there's it's not like casting you out and saying screw you, right? So there's like an inherent warmth in that I think I generally feel towards a viewer, right? That it's like I really don't take pleasure in kind of talking down to you or something,
yeah.
You know what I mean? And so with that said, I think it's not about creating the maximum amount of visual pleasure or something. Like it's kind of this game between the two of what I know sparks visual pleasure from, you know, paintings and from how we just see things. Thinking about how someone will look at the painting and then play into that and play out of that, you know. So it's figuring out what those expectations and associations will be on a more like broad scale, and letting that inform the painting in a way that becomes kind of a game.